Welcome to this Good Lit podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California. The Good Lit series brings literary and culinary luminaries to the podium. I'm Gina Bellaria, Director of Literary Events at the club. To learn more about our programs or become a member, go to commonwealthclub.org. To take part in a discussion about what you hear, blog at commonwealthlit.blogspot.com.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. This program is part of our Good Lit series, generously underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. I'm John McMurtry, book editor of the San Francisco Chronicle. And now it is my pleasure to introduce Richard North Patterson, best-selling author whose latest novel is Eclipse. Like the novelist Scott Turow, a good friend of his, Mr. Patterson writes stories that are informed by his legal background. A native of Berkeley, Mr. Patterson grew up in Ohio, where he became an assistant attorney general. He worked as a trial lawyer for many years, retiring in 1993 to devote himself full-time to fiction writing. Mr. Patterson has written 16 novels, each of which deals with such weighty issues as abortion, gun control, and the Arab-Israeli conflict. Eclipse is a gripping novel, a mix of courtroom drama and conspiracy thriller. It's full of fast-paced scenes and corporate shenanigans. It's also a love story. The big theme this time is oil politics. Eclipse is set partly in the Bay Area, where Mr. Patterson lives, but mostly the novel takes place in a fictional African country called Luandia. As we'll hear from Mr. Patterson, Luandia is modeled after Nigeria, a country that's rich in oil but has a poor record on human rights. One of the underlying questions of the novel is to what extent will the West compromise its democratic principles in order to secure a cheap source of oil? Mr. Patterson may not propose an answer, but his novel raises this and other important issues and a thrilling story for all of us to consider. Please welcome Richard North Patterson.
Thank you, John.
Now, to start off with, the genesis of this novel goes back, I think, about 15 years to events that occurred in Africa. If you could share with us what happened at that point.
Yeah, it began with a remarkable man named Ken Charawiwa, who was a Nigerian playwright and novelist, environmentalist, and a man of incredible charisma, great courage, and a lover of people, not including women, but particularly the Ogoni tribe among whom he was raised before he was educated in England. Charawiwa was imbued with the ideals of the West, and as a result, he came to believe that in spite of the utter lack of tradition for such a thing in Nigeria, that he could start a mass movement among his tribe, the Ogoni, to protest the despoliation of their region by the oil companies. Now, oil had been discovered in Nigeria in the early 1970s, had been exploited in such a way that it was gradually turning the Delta into an environmental wasteland where previously fertile farmland was destroyed, previously rich fishing waters were essentially denuded of fish, where sometimes potable water became so hard to find that you'd have to walk for hours to get it. It was Sarawiwa's belief that he could rally the West and also his people to protest the misuse of oil revenues and the ruin of his land. His problem was that Nigeria is a dictatorship which had one thing that the West and others desperately needed, which is oil to fuel our industries and run our cars. The tragedy was that he believed that moral force could overcome economics, and it didn't. The short of it was that the dictator of the moment, General Sani Abacha, who was both ruthless and very clever, charged Charawiwa on flimsy evidence with the murder of four political rivals, dragged him before a kangaroo court which had no resemblance to courts as we know them or even courts in Nigeria, which included a colonel who reported him directly, from which the only appeal was to Abacha himself, and proceeded to engineer his conviction and sentencing to death for murder. A great deal of agonizing ensued. People wrote letters. Western governments protested. They all said it was a terrible thing, and Abacha hung him. That was in 1994. It always stuck in my mind because not only was this man a remarkable human being who took risks which required incredible ideals and moral courage, but he had been let down badly by the calculation that somehow human rights trumped oil, when in fact it was the other way around. I was among members of PEN who wrote letters to Abacha protesting all this, which if he even read them must have amused him a great deal. But it always stuck with me. So a long answer, I know, but it's a complicated situation. In 2001, when we had the Al-Qaeda attack on the United States and the ensuing disaster in Iraq, worry about other sources of oil, our geopolitical strategists turned to Nigeria, and particularly in the Niger Delta, Sarawiwa's homeland, as a source of potential oil. So history had come full circle. We needed them more than ever, and we had no more leverage than we ever did to care about how the oil was taken, what happened to the Delta. The Delta, I can tell you, is 15 years worse. And I thought, okay, this is a, you know, the fact that this place is hell on earth also makes it a terrific setting for a novel and a way of exploring the geopolitics of oil in the post 9/11 world. So that's what I set out to do.
So did you travel there first, thinking that this could be a place where
First of all, I interviewed everybody that I possibly could. I mean, I talked to Susan Rice, who's now our ambassador to UN, Jim Jones, who is now the National Security Advisor to Obama, several ambassadors, human rights workers, lawyers who were involved in suing oil companies for massacres allegedly perpetrated to make oil companies' operations more secure. I talked to people in Nigeria. I talked to judges. I did everything I could. And then after I thoroughly prepared myself, I actually traveled to Nigeria, which to put it mildly, is one of the most remarkable places I've ever been, and who was pervaded by the tragedy, which is oil. It's pretty easy. I can talk more about Nigeria at some point, but pretty easier to see after being there the argument that Nigeria would have been a hell of a lot better off had oil never been discovered, because the wealth, oil money is easy to steal. The government, being in government, becomes a way of making yourself rich. The oil companies do well, the guys in government do well, and the people just get absolutely ripped off. The standard of living for the average Nigerian is worse than it was in 1970. So it was enlightening.
So this story, it's really centered on one character, Damon Pierce, an American, a former war crimes prosecutor, right?
And
his involvement with a woman who he meets in a writing group in Berkeley, it is. And she gets involved with this man from Luandia.
Yeah. The Sarawiwa figure, isn't
it? Yes. And goes to Africa, lives with him, marries him. And years later, I think it is, several years later, right? They're in contact through email.
Right.
And he decides to travel to Africa to...
Well,
the
triggering event is the massacre of people in...
Right, thank
in,
you.
...in Bobby Okari's, the human rights leader's, home village. And his wife, Marissa, contacts Pierce, who is an international human rights lawyer, among other things, to see whether there's any way of saving Bobby and perhaps herself from a very grim fate. And one thing I try to do in writing novels, I mean, there's no point in pretending I'm a Nigerian. So I have to start with a point of view which is like mine. Somebody who is a lawyer, somebody who has some experience with trying to figure things out, but comes into a society from the outside. So the narrator, Pierce, actually discovers Nigeria and some of the remarkable things about him, just as I would, just as you would, just as somebody who's coming from the outside. It's a good way to design a narrative. But I will also say that three of the principal characters, including Bobby Okari, who's inspired by Ken Sarawiwa. The dictator, Xavier Karama, who's inspired by the late lamented Sani Abacha, and his enforcer, Paulo Kimbo. All three of the latter characters are drawn from life, as complicated and in a couple of cases horrifying as they may be. Very closely drawn in terms of character and psychology from people who actually existed. So it was an interesting way to write a novel because I both took my point of view and I tried in detail to explore the character of Sarawiwa. Example, I talked to his brother Owens, among others, and I talked to many associates who had been with Sarawiwa at the time that he made some critical decisions. So I get a real decision for who he was and in some ways how complicated he was.
Mm. So part of this novel really is giving voice in a way to someone who, I mean, there was a lot of press attention given to his case at the time, but to explore all the issues involved, I think, with him.
To revive in some way what he was trying to say, to revive him as a figure of historical memory in some small way. His son is still keeping his memory alive, as does his brother Owens. But I venture to say that if I were to take a mass audience in most cities in America, San Francisco less so than some, very few people would know or remember Ken Sarawiwa. And that's understandable, but it's also a shame.
Mm. When you traveled to Nigeria, there must have been, what were some of the things that you learned or saw that made it into the novel?
The first thing I got, one of my friends is Bill Cohen, the Secretary of Defense. Under Clinton, I start getting call from Bill and others saying, you know, here you're going to Nigeria. And actually, Bill knew. He said, and we think you're crazy. And then at one point, one of the guys at the Cohen Group got an email from somebody he talked to. Patterson wants to go to Nigeria. If you have any influence, stop him. I'm no adventurer. I'm not trying to cast this as a death-defying enterprise, but. The novel focuses on the Niger Delta, and the Niger Delta is a remarkable place. After Sarawiwa died, where there was no nonviolent outlet for anger and protest, what happened is the Niger Delta devolved into a killing ground for a bunch of different militia groups, very heavily armed, often for money, gotten kidnapping oil executives or siphoning oil into the black market. Fought each other, sometimes in the street of Port Harcourt. In addition, all of them fought the government at the same time they weren't bribing and screwing the government, and it is the most treacherous environment you can imagine. When I talked to security guards, security firms, they would say, like, we can protect you from the airport to the hotel, but if somebody wanted to take you, and they very well could, you could be outgunned. Not only that, but kidnapping's a growth industry, and not only that, but the Nigerian security services will be very unamused when you start talking to heads of militia groups. Quick vignette. One of the things I ended up not doing after I got to Nigeria, in spite of everybody's advice, was going around with a woman named Judy Asuni, who was an American expat married in Nigeria who had been working in and among militia groups in peacemaking efforts for about 30 years. And when I told Judy that my security folks were saying not to go, she said basically, you know, they're chickens. Don't you be one. I've been running around for 30 years. I'm fine. I'll take you out there. No sweat. Nobody will bother us. Well, I found that pretty persuasive. I mean, she'd been around for 30 years. I really wanted to do this. I went back and forth with my security guys, and then finally they said, you know, look, we can't shoot you to keep you from going, but we'd like to. And I said, okay. Well, so I talked to Junie on the phone, and we went back and forth. And 2 weeks later, she was picked up by the Nigerian security services with a couple of German documentarians she was taking around a similar mission, thrown in a Nigerian jail for 3 months. Nobody knew when they were going to get her out. Finally, they kicked her out of the country, and she can't go back probably ever. Hmm. And given that I didn't have in mind writing a prison novel, certainly not one that involved me, I was just as happy. But the other thing, which I sort of can't get into, is the number of conspiracy and other theories I heard about why Judy had been thrown in jail in the first place and sort of what that was all about. And it sort of gave me an even better sense of the environment that I was dealing with, where the political environment is so treacherous. You know who's your friend, and you know where they're going to flip on you. And when somebody tells you something, it may be true and it may be not. And it's not ultimately a commentary on the character of the Nigerian people, who are, I found, as a group, remarkably bright and enterprising and energetic, and among whom they're really gutsy human rights folks, but just the character of the environment. I mean, it really is Al Capone Chicago metastasized. It's crazy.
And maybe at this point you could speak about why you chose to fictionalize the place, to not set it in Nigeria, but in this place, Luanda.
Well, some small and I think highly appropriate sense of humility. I mean, Nigeria is a country of 150 million people. It has about 250 ethnic groups. It is split, among other things, between Muslims and Christians, and of course various kinds of subgroups. It has a complicated colonial history, and there are a great many things about Nigeria that mean that even people who've been there for years, including ambassadors I talked to, who said they really knew something about the country, didn't really think they understood it. So I figured, okay, I can understand oil and how it works. I can understand all the web of corruption around there. I can understand the environmental ruin of the Niger Delta. I can understand what makes this the most corrupt place on the planet. And I can take that aspect and drill it to the ground as best I can and turn it into a country called Luanda that will have all the features I'm writing about, but will not set me up for something I'm not qualified to be as some sort of self-appointed expert in Nigeria. So that's why I did it that way.
Just a reminder for our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and we're talking with best-selling author Richard North Patterson. I'm wondering, the book's just come out here recently, but any word on whether the novel's being read in Nigeria?
Well, the first problem is mainly it's in Nigeria. And I'm not joking. I mean, one of the things that I always do when I interview people, and I interviewed about 80 folks, is the least I can do is give them a gift book at the end of this, which I sign and get off. And among the tricky things I've been trying to figure is how to get it to people in Nigeria. So that there's a fair shot that they'll actually receive it. And I've been going through emails with a variety of folks about how to do that. So one of these days, the folks who I interviewed are going to get it and tell me what they think. So far, people who I know who know something about Nigeria and have read the book don't tend to be finding a lot of fault with it. And I try to write books assuming the audience are people who know what it is that I'm writing about, because I figure if I get it right for them, I've got it right for everybody else.
Well, maybe a paperback version, it'll be easier to get over there. I don't know what's coming out in paperback. But.
Yeah, it is eventually, but I urge everyone to buy the hardback.
Right. I realize that
my children have
risky
their needs.
Have you traveled? You must have traveled a little bit in the Mideast for exile.
Quite a bit. And that was a pretty profound experience, too. I could talk about it endlessly, which my answers sort of tend to be, it seeming, tonight. But a quick vignette about that. I try to interview people from a variety of circumstances and walks of life. One of the hardest interviews I've ever done was an interview in Haifa with two women who survivors of a suicide bombing, two women who had lost their only two children and their husband in the same bombing, and another family who had lost one of two children, their only daughter. And it was a wrenching thing to do, which I felt that I wanted to do and should do for this book, but hard. The next day I went to see the Israeli general who was in charge of internal security, among other things, trying to prevent such tragedies from happening. In this case, a Palestinian from Jenin, the refugee camp on the West Bank, had walked into a a restaurant in Haifa during Passover and just blowing himself up and lots of other people as well. And the general said to me, you know, the famous military operation in Jenin in which 50-some people were killed and about which the Palestinians complain was in retaliation for this and other suicide bombings planned in Jenin. In due course, I went to Jenin, and I made it known that I wished to meet with somebody underground, either a head of Hamas or the rival group, the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, and asked them whatever I could understand how they saw the world. And after a lot of lacarious backing and forth, the fourth thing I did, and I was taken to see a man who was head of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade in Jenin, was on the Israeli Army's shoot-to-kill list, moved every hour, more or less, had eyes like raccoons because he never slept. And while I interviewed him, he was sitting there with an AK-47 on his lap and two bodyguards also with AK-47s. The room was enclosed, so nobody can see us. And it dawned on me the Israeli Army knew that we were there. You know, they could lob an RPG on us, and I would become collateral damage in the name of literature, which is not amusing. But the most interesting thing about it is when I asked him, I said, you know, the Israeli Army insists that the incursion in Jenin, about which you so complain, and by the way, they'd shown me the graveyard where they claimed mostly civilian victims were there, was in retaliation for suicide bombing in Haifa. He said, oh, no. The suicide bombing in Haifa was in retaliation for earlier bad things they'd done to us here. And without any sense of irony. And what that encapsulated for me was the degree to which the parallel narratives, which never seemed to cross in that part of the world, are so strong, and everybody can go back to a root cause, which is always the other guy. And there is no communication between people otherwise recognizably human types with the same thoughts, feelings, hopes, and fears that we all have. And that's the tragedy of it. I always thought the degree to which so many people in that part of the world are so caught in their own narrative that they can't break out of it to see the narrative of the other.
Are you getting more feedback these days? I mean, the Mideast, it's obviously, tensions are growing there right now. Been problems for a long time, but I wonder if you've had feedback recently or
I do.
Been out there more.
I do. Exile, that novel, came out in January of 2007, and it has had a very long life. And I have gotten exponentially more correspondence about that than any other novel I've ever written, I think because this is so close to so many people. I certainly have emotional feelings about it. And among, you know, I've spoken a lot of places, including I've been asked to speak at various synagogues on this issue. And I have been struck time and again and moved by the number of letters I've gotten from people who either say, you have reinforce my lonely feelings about this, or very often, I really only saw X side, and you really made me think about another aspect of this, and thank you. And that's the most rewarding thing. I mean, if you feel like you've entertained people, and you've done that too, it's the most rewarding thing that you know, a writer can hope to have.
I'm wondering about your writing. You write, obviously, about these big, divisive issues. How much of a challenge is it to write about such themes without coming across as heavy-handed, especially in the dialogue, to tone that down?
Oh, it's hard. It's really hard. You know, first of all, when I started this, my then publisher was, shall we say, less than wholly delighted. You know, it's like, you know, why write this stink bomb? It's difficult, and here's the deal, and I hope I've succeeded in Eclipse. I mean, the reviews suggest I have, thank God, but readers are the ultimate test of that. You have to be able to let people know something that they may not have thought about without letting go of their emotion or losing the thread of the story. They have to feel like they're learning while they're still being engaged in the fate of the people, place, and plot. And that requires you to constantly make calculations. I'm constantly throwing stuff out. I'm constantly trying to make sure I'm not writing a lecture or a bound sleeping pill in novel form. In last spring, I wrote a book, which is my next book out, which I like a lot and which people like a lot, called The Spire, which some people will be thrilled to know has no redeeming social value whatsoever. and, I mean, not a thing, and there's enough sex, too. And it was like a vacation. It really was, you know. And I realized, and I sat there and thought, okay, I'm just concerned about the psychology of these people and their character and where they live and how their past develops them and what happens in next. And God, this is what most novels do all the time. This is like pretty good. There's no shame in telling a good story. I mean, I really love that. I mean, I love making stuff up, and I've basically got a storyteller sensibility, and I'm not embarrassed by the mechanics of fiction. So that's fine for its own sake. Bottom line, it's really a trick to do that and do something else. And if you pull it off, I think it's a good thing.
Did you feel you needed a vacation? How'd it come about, this book? It's The Spire, right?
You know, I don't know exactly. My assistant actually reminded me that I'd once proposed to write a novel about a college campus. Hmm. And it was about the same time that there was a fallout from that Duke incident, where what appeared to be a racially motivated horror began to take on other shadings. I'm not sure that anybody is ever going to quite know exactly the ins and outs of that thing. But that got me thinking about a story about a potentially racially tinged murder on a college campus and its resonance in the life of the campus some years later, when it starts to look like maybe what appeared to happen isn't quite the way it happened, and how that affects three characters in particular. And it just got to be fun. What's wrong with that?
Sure.
So I did.
In the meantime, you've also, I think, been working on a courtroom drama titled Honor. It's about a military court-martial of an Army officer. Is that right?
Yeah. 25 years ago, I started to get interested in the phenomenon of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorders, that affected veterans of Vietnam. And it's become clear that what we're dealing with, you know, in the wake of Iraq and Afghanistan is something like a mental health tsunami. There are estimates that 300,000, there's a study by the RAND Corporation, 300,000 soldiers from Afghanistan and Iraq are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder of various degrees of severity, often accentuated by traumatic brain injuries, because the kind of stuff they're dealing with, rocket-propelled grenades and improvised explosive devices, among other things. If they don't kill you, they can literally, you know, disarrange your cranium in ways that are bad for cognitive functioning. So I started to deal with that, and then being a lawyer, started to put it in the context of a criminal defense. It turned out, I discovered, that post-traumatic stress disorder has never been used successfully in a criminal defense in an Army court-martial or as a direct matter in a federal court at all. So I designed a plot where one officer kills another. They are both enmeshed in two interrelated military families with a military tradition. They have both come back from Iraq, where one was the other's company commander. And one of the defenses is post-traumatic stress disorder, in essence, that a very emotionally fraught situation between the two of them involving the wife of the victim triggered reactions not solely confined to the circumstance at hand, but resonant with the experience they both had in Iraq. And it's been fascinating to write. I'm sort of in the middle of it now.
Mm. You're not a lawyer anymore, and I think you're pretty happy about that.
It's really okay.
and yet you do get to do a lot of the work that you might have done as a lawyer, the research, talking to people, putting a case together, as it were, for a book.
Yeah, well, people are really tough on lawyers. I mean, the truth is, I like being one, and to coin a phrase, many of my best friends are and continue to be. The great thing about being a lawyer, actually, a number of good things about it for a writer. For one thing, you get used to asking questions and doing research, and if you're curious by nature, that really helps. The other thing is there's a great assumption that lawyers just write the worst crap in the world. They write this Latinate, awful things, you know, that just can't be penetrated by anyone. And in some forms of the law, that's somewhat true. But the truth is many of my pals in the law will recognize, when you're writing for court, you're writing for America's most tired and cynical audience, America's judges and their law clerks. And you better get it clear, and you better get it right, and you better make it pretty interesting, or they're going to tune you out. Mm-hmm. And the last thing about being a litigator, which is pretty good if you're going to be a novelist, is you have to take a bunch of messy facts, arrange them in a narrative that makes sense and is coherent. You try to make your client or your client's cases appealing in human terms as you possibly can. And you turn out to be an interpreter of psychology, both your client, maybe a jury, maybe a judge, maybe the folks on the other side, whatever it is. And so you're dealing with narrative, and you're dealing with character, and you're dealing with the ability to tell a story in as clear and interesting way as you can. You think about that, that's a lot of what novels have to do. So, I mean, the reason that a lot of people are, you know, lawyers or writers is not because they ran screaming out of the office one day and said, "Stop me before I kill again." You know, it's also that they have a real good gig for becoming a novelist. Mm.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and we're talking with best-selling author Richard North Patterson. Yeah, I think what I meant about the law specifically was that you didn't miss putting in the hours for someone else, say, that you're happy to be your own boss.
Well, that's a key point because I think there's a great deal of creativity in the law that I think people on the outside don't recognize. In between the interstices of cases and precedent, there's a lot of room for imagination. But still, all in all, it's an inbox kind of job. You basically deal with a problem somebody else brings you, and you maybe find it an interesting problem, and maybe like the folks who are involved. But still, I mean, you are the receptacle of other people's problems. The great thing about writing is entirely self-directed. I mean, you figure out what you want to write about, and then you figure out how to find it out. And then you figure out how to tell the story. I mean, it is the ultimate in self-directed work, much more so than many forms of art, if you will, really. So for somebody who doesn't mind being their own boss, in fact, likes it a whole lot, and, you know, had to figure out a way to channel their fantasy life left over from childhood, you know, it is like the best job I can imagine. People ask me if I want to go into politics. I say, "Are you kidding me? Hmm. I like to make up politicians."
Right. When did you know you wanted to become a writer? When you were a lawyer or before that?
Well, you know, I think I remarked to you, we were together last, or somebody asked me, and I said something to dredge this up, but I mean, yeah, I thought about being a writer when I was a kid about the same way that I thought about marrying Princess Carolina Monaco. It was sort of aspirational in a vague sort of way, and you'll note my wife is here, Princess Caroline is not, and it's really fine. But I'll try to make this short, but I remember unlike most writers, I remember the actual day I decided to become a writer. I was 29. I'd just been made a partner in a law firm. I was on my third stupid business trip in 3 weeks, ordered by a federal judge to do a bunch of meaningless stuff. And the trip was so dumb. It was the kind of thing you get on a plane and you think, it serves me right if this crashes. This is a complete stupid. And I was going out to the cab, and I see my one-year-old son, Brooke, who is now 32. And he's waving at me through the screen door of our house. And I'm feeling miserable because I don't want to leave the kid. And I But I realize why I am, because the door that he's waving through is surrounded by a house which is paid for by a mortgage, which is supported by me, and the only way that I can do that is by annoying people for money. That's my job. And so I got on a plane. I had one plane change. I got on a plane and said, okay, what else in the world are you good for besides this? And it occurred to me, no kidding, I'd read 17 Ross McDonald novels in a row on similar stupid business trips, and that I had assimilated without quite consciously trying to, the way that Ross McDonald, a very fine writer, did certain things. And so I thought, well, I'll be a writer. You don't need to pass a test. You don't have to have any known qualifications whatsoever. So I rough out a plot, and I get to Denver, and I write a scene. And then I was so embarrassed by my presumption, I hid this thing for about 6 weeks. I finally suck it up and go to a beginning writer's class at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. I was living in Alabama at the time. And the woman who's teaching it is a poet, and she asks us all what we're doing. Well, I'm sure my memory isn't quite right, but my memory now, it was about me and 14 very nice ladies with blue hair writing love poetry to Jesus. And they say what they're doing, you know, and she asked me one day, I said, well, I'm writing a novel, and she gives me this look of pity and astonishment. And says, have you ever written anything before? This is a beginning class. And I said, no, I've never written anything before. And she said, don't you think you should try a short story first? And I said, no, I think I'm a novelist. And she was astounded. So she said, well, bring in what you're writing. I figured she was going to, like, put me to sleep like a dead cat. And I did, and she loved it. And so I was so pathetically grateful, I kept writing this thing for her, basically. And I, you know, I had a certain amount of misery associated with that, like 13 rejection letters and 3 rewrites. But I finally got it published. It won an award. You know, it sold several copies, many to family. But I was a novelist. I actually had written something that was in a bookstore.
Well, it seems almost these days as if the best, one of the best routes to becoming a novelist is either becoming a lawyer first or a doctor, and then using a lot of these experiences.
I've never thought that doctors could write. Forgive me, any of you in the audience. there are indeed a few. I mean, all kidding aside, there are, you know, a couple of people who've done well, and it's a pretty elegant, stylish. Lawyers, it's kind of a more obvious,
right?
Kind of just sort of giving a. Given the nature of that business, it's a hard business to get started in. All the more so because of the flux in publishing, I'm sorry to say. But my old writing teacher, Jesse Hill Ford, a very fine novelist from Tennessee, always said, sooner or later, almost everything that's good gets published. And I have to believe with a lot of determination and character that it's true. The thing that I urge people to remember, aside from get an agent because they mediate, a good agent offers us a validator, is remember that good writing is rewriting, that your first word is never as good as your last, and take that story, that novel, and make it as good as you can, and don't give up until you have. I was in a group of 15 writers under studied with Jesse Ford. I thought 2 or 3 of them were more talented than I was. You know, I don't have a particularly modest opinion of my own abilities. I'm the one who by far has been the most successful. And it's not a matter of being better. It's a matter of being flat persistent. It's a matter of having the law beat into me that you always do the best you can. And you don't let something go until you've made that written work as good as you can. So one of the guys, for example, was the best writer of 80% good enough novels that never gets published you've ever seen. And that's a shame because it's a waste. So I urge professionalism and non-dreaminess on young writers, for whom I feel a good deal of sympathy, by the way, because I used to be one.
Have you tutored any writers, young writers?
I have occasionally talked at writing seminars, and I am a great dispenser of free advice to people generally. I mean, I have only so much to say because there are different ways of being a good writer, and I don't assume that my way of writing a novel is the only way. But I do think that there are certain keys to the character of a writer which are important.
I'm wondering, if I'm not mistaken, none of your novels have been adapted into movies, right?
I've had movie deals. And movie deals, I've decided, are somewhat like sperm. Many are called, but few are chosen. I mean, I've got like every bad Hollywood story there is, and so does anybody who's at one point or another has sold a lot of books. I mean, like every bad story. I've had a miniseries, which was interesting. For those of you who remember Degree of Guilt and Eyes of a Child, they were combined into a miniseries called Degree of Guilt. And the plot of Eyes of a Child, some may recall, involved the assertion and ultimate reality of childhood sexual abuse as a motive for murder. This was on NBC. About 2 years before, my friend Ted Danson had starred in a film called Something About Amelia, which dealt with the question of sexual abuse very directly. No problem. But in that 2 years, the Christian Right and the Decency folks had gotten more and more on this one. And by the time I got to NBC and sold the rights and saw the first script, which was reasonably honest, I was suddenly told on the eve of shooting that they had had to eliminate the motive and thus the sense of the entire second half of the miniseries, which no longer made any psychological sense at all. I remember one of the actors saying, you know, what do I do now? And I said, damned if I know. It's a strange beast. I mean, the one thing that I have never concerned myself with is sitting out and trying to write a book that'll turn into a movie. Mm-hmm. And indeed, my books do things that most people in Hollywood hate. For one thing, they require reading, a problem for many. Another thing is that they have flashbacks, which may require two different people playing the same character at different ages. Hate that. And they also involve controversy. Not much excitement about, you know, we're going to write the great book about partial birth abortion, quote unquote. That's a real date movie. So basically, I write for readers, and whatever else happens.
Gotcha. I was just thinking, reading it, that Exile, it's very cinematic in a lot of ways. The writing, it's snappy, and the great locales. So I was curious.
Yeah, it's the only problem is subject matter. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are a lot of people that really want to stay away from that one. Although I find that dealing with it was rewarding. The other thing in Hollywood is really weird. Producers do know that Israel and the West Bank are located in the Middle East. They're also aware that several movies about the Middle East have not done too well at the box office. So for them, it's a simple thing. Oh, another one of those. Middle East doesn't work. My only other experience with this briefly is one day I was lying in a swimming pool on Martha's Vineyard, and I don't work in the summer on the theory that if you have a thin talent, you have to nurture it every now and again and you know, let the subconscious sort of replenish. And I get a call from a woman saying, have you thought about conceiving a television series? To which I said, not at all, and I have no interest. I said, I won't go to meetings. I won't go to Hollywood. I won't sit around with some kid, rewriting a script, and I won't write the script, so I'm no good to you. And she said, oh, no, you have a name, you have a reputation, dream something up. So, next time I was in an airport, I dreamed something up. And by God, we went through two or three meetings on the phone with folks in Hollywood, and they're getting more interested. And then suddenly it was like, we can't do this. I said, why not? And they said, well, two reasons. Your protagonist is a guy. Do you think you could make him a woman? I said, for various reasons, given that he has a father complex, among other things, that probably would not work too well. And he said, well, the other problem is none of your characters have superpowers. And more, I mean, and this is about a law firm. You know, I kid you not. And right now, superpowers are very big, you know, like heroes, you know. And I said, yeah, okay, fine. That was that. Now, this is a true story.
A reminder, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with best-selling author Richard North Patterson. And we have a question from the audience about your writing, and are you still writing in longhand?
Oh, Lord, yes. Mm. My late colleague and better, Bill Styron, wrote longhand for much of his life. But for me, it's the reasons are really embarrassing. I'm of that antiquated generation that never learned to type and always had a secretary. And, oh, God help me. And when you were in college, you took it to the nice girl down the hall that would type it for 50 cents a page. And I've never learned to type. The rhythm of writing suits me. I fax it to my assistant, who owns me, because he's the only person in America can read my writing. She faxes it back, and it already looks so much better, because my writing is like Cyrillic. Then when I read it, I really feel heartened. Oh, you're writing well today. Look at this when it's in type. That's just the way it's gone, and probably the way it's going to go.
And the follow-up is, how are you able to write so many novels, writing longhand?
An absence of carpal tunnel syndrome, I suppose. I don't know that if I typed them that they'd go any faster. Maybe they would. But I know why I'm able to be productive, which is that in that 9.5 months a year I work, I mean, I work damn hard. And I'll get up, I'll be writing by 7 o'clock, and I won't quit until, say, 5 or so, when I've done all the rewriting. I was preaching so much about it and think I've made this as best as I can. I do it 5 days a week. I sort of show up like a civil servant. And the other thing is that, you know, some readers might suspect, the architecture of my books is very carefully designed. I do a lot of research, and then I'll outline the book so carefully that it goes like this. I'll have a folder, as I did today. Have a folder for every scene or chapter. And it'll have an outline of generally what's supposed to happen in the typed research notes in order which support that which I need to know to write the scene. So I don't show up saying, what do I do today? I know. And what that means is I'm very productive. I'm never throwing out 200 pages. Because I just started writing something and didn't know what the hell I was doing and realized that it just was no longer made sense. And that has the added virtue that I think, and I hope that my books make sense. We've all read books, and Tom Wolfe, I generally admire a great, great deal, is guilty of this, which are good about 90% of the way through, and then it falls off the cliff. And what I learned, to my complete surprise, is Wolf doesn't know how the novel is going to end until about 3 months before they're published, and then he sort of does something. And what I try to do is, with whatever talent I possess, and Wolf's talents for writing are prodigious, is to design an ending which resonates back to the beginning so that not only the events make sense, but the psychological development and the progression of the characters make sense. So you have a wholly integrated experience. And I think probably most writers of the most epic gifts do that. I mean, maybe Melville set out to write a book about a big fish and see what happened. Well, I kind of think he knew. Mm-hmm. And I think that helps a lot. Mm.
Another question from the audience, a topical one. Is Iran really as much of a threat to Mideast peace and to the U.S. as you imply in Exile? If so, how do you know?
I know what I think. And more to the point, I know what a lot of people who know more than I do think. But the question of Iran is a complicated one, so let me answer it as best I can. Yes, Iran is a threat to Middle East peace. Yes, they're developing nuclear weapons. And yes, the disaster, which is the Israeli-Palestinian tragedy, is enabling them to extend their reach in the Middle East through surrogates like Hamas and Hezbollah. It is also true that Iran is a complicated society. It's also true that our sins with respect to Iran are many and historic, but certainly including the deposing Mossadegh in a CIA-fueled plot back in the 50s, driven by oil, which gave them the Shah, the gift that kept on giving to anti-Americanism, and well, it should have. So we have our sins. It is further true that Iran is a complicated society with some real secular elements, the mullahs and the Republican Guard are not by any means wholly representative of that society, and further, that they are estranged from us for a variety of reasons. Finally, it is also true that the failure of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, including the last 8 years, where we essentially punted the Israeli-Palestinian dilemma, has created a situation very different than the one that we had in 2000. So, yes, I mean, I think the shadow of a nuclear Iran very much hangs over the Middle East, but I think that's the beginning of the story and not the end. And it's very complicated, and the United States had a role in that, mm-hmm. a considerable one.
A note from somebody in the audience who simply like to thank you for remembering Ken Sarawiwa, and that this person had heard a great deal about him on the CBC, but read little, not much about him in the American media.
There wasn't much. The New York Times was one exception. The Goldman Foundation here, which gave Sarawiwa its environmental role, mm-hmm. prize, played a real role in awakening America to Sarawiwa. And there are lawsuits now, by the way, I should mention, including in the United States District Court here in San Francisco before Judge Elston and also before Judge Kimball Wood in New York. Which deal with human rights abuses, including deaths, in which the plaintiffs accuse oil companies, who were the protectees of the government, of complicity in those. Now, the legal issues and the moral issues of those are very complicated, because the oil companies, for all their early environmental sins, also are in a very difficult situation in those societies. But those lawsuits, to some extent, are also resurrecting issues raised by Ken Sarawiwa. Hmm.
Are you ever afraid? You've written 16. This is your 16th novel, right?
Mm-hmm.
Written about so
sounds
many,
like a lot.
In how many years? I mean, it is a lot.
Well, in my second career is the one where I've written consecutively, and that started in '93, and I guess by the time I finish Honor this spring, that'll be my 14th novel since I started Degree of Guilt in 1992.
Each covers, as I've said, weighty issues, and I just wonder sometimes if you feel you might be running out of material. If you, there's a lot in this world, obviously. But,
yeah. Well, I mean, there always is that chasm where you think the floor is going to open from under you. You just drop through it, and you don't have another thought worth writing about. I worry about that from time to time. I mean, you see some writers like Philip Roth, he continues to produce at a very high level. Mm-hmm. Other people just sort of drop off the clip. I mean, Ross remarkable peer, John Updike, enjoyed, I would say, less critical success in his latter years than he did earlier on. You know, but for me, who is engaged in the world and thinking about the world, there are always fresh outrages. Hmm. And just the infinite variety of human behavior. I mean, skip politics or geopolitics or law or social problems or any of that. I mean, if you think about men and women parents and children in our in the way we realize our ambitions and desires, boy, there's enough to keep you writing for a long time. Mm. So I think I'll probably be okay for the next little while.
Yeah. Any outrages that come to mind, subjects you'd like to cover?
Loose nuclear materials leaps to mind. And I've started to ask idle questions about it. One thing that is kind of inescapable if you start to look at these things is the degree to which a destabilized Pakistan is not a really good thing. I know very little about it, but they were running a nuclear bazaar in Pakistan for a long time, and AQ Khan, the originator of their nuclear program, was selling nuclear know-how to all sorts of people. Now, I kind of can't believe he was doing that. Nobody else knew about it. But there is the question now of a lot of fissile material. I mean, the Soviet Union is one source, North Korea is another, Pakistan is a third. And I'm starting to think about, the damage that could be done by loose nukes on the open market in somebody, say, sitting around in the middle of a population compact city like New York. So it's another feel-good concept, but it's a real interesting one, and it's one that people who are serious thinkers about internal security worry about a lot. But it's another one that isn't getting a whole lot of sustained attention in the media. It's a worthwhile thinking about. I'm also thinking about just sort of more rich veins of sex, passion, greed, and the other emotions which make us great.
So 3.5 months you have in the summer, no writing.
Two and a half. I don't want to excite MD.
Are you reading a lot in that time, too?
I do read a lot. I'm kind of careful about what I read, and I try not to read something which I think is going to influence consciously or unconsciously what it is that I'm doing. If I read something specifically for the purpose of writing, it's for research purposes, and it's for facts, not technique. But, yeah, I read all sorts of things, and I read old fiction and new fiction and a lot of nonfiction, a lot of political stuff, because I'm a political junkie and have been engaged in that world in various ways from time to time. So, yeah, I'm always reading. To me, it's one of the great pleasures. I like movies, but a movie does all the work for you. Mm-hmm. Basically, you're sitting there, and they give you the characters, they give you the screen, and they give you 2 hours, and that's the time in which you're going to do that. So much of reading a book, to use the cliche, is interactive. I mean, we supply the images. We read at our own rhythm. We have our own subjective descriptions, notions, feelings about, what we're reading. It's always, to me, been a very rewarding thing to do. And the magic for me, it felt like magic, was I realized that in some way I could create this thing that I'd always loved so much.
Mm. What have you been reading lately that you like?
Oh, gosh. I just finished Revolutionary Road. Mm. And only because, ironically, there was a movie. This book is supposed to be a classic. God help me, didn't know it existed. It is one of the most astonishing pieces of writing that I've ever seen. And the couple are so closely observed, and their faults and their fears and their hopes are explored so precisely that it makes you squirm, but you just can't turn away. It's just so utterly absorbing. This is a remarkably perceptive man. I also gather a remarkably misanthropic one. But he did something extraordinary in this. I'm also reading Peter Matheson's Shadow Country, which is not easy reading, but it's very dense. But it's a retelling of a myth of a real estate developer slash murderer in the turn of the century Florida. Actually, real estate murder does not strike me as all that much of a stretch. But it has a kind of mythic quality to it in its description of the natural environment in these people is terrific.
Hmm. I have to ask you if you've ever, or recently, if you've given thought to something about the economy, and you had some relationship in the Watergate era to... Well,
boy, you know, when nonprofit came up, it really resonated for me because I've been looking at my investments. I was in that world for a long time, the world of alleged financial fraud. And there are fascinating aspects to it. I mean, Bernard Madoff is a study. And I would love to be able to know how you can sustain that level of deception, present yourself, and evidently feel about yourself in many ways that you're a good guy, and then screw some of your best friends and Eli Wiesel and half the Jewish charities in New York. I mean, I just don't know how you sustain that kind of dissonance. And that's fascinating. On the other hand, I am really angry. Mm-hmm. About this thing, and I may be a little too angry to write about it. The real estate bubble was so goddamned obvious, and the level of greed that it took for people to do that, the level of self-satisfied greed that it took for those clowns on Wall Street to repackage this thing till Warren Buffett couldn't understand it, and of course, unlike a lot of people, wouldn't buy it, is absolutely amazing. The degree of greed, the degree of neglect by the government, the degree of moral failure on behalf of all of us who believe that we can live on unsustainable credit forever and ever and ever is just remarkable. And I may be just sort of too hacked off to write about it.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for only one last question, and I thought I'd ask you about Barack Obama. I know that Bill Clinton is a fan of your books. Some people in the Bush family also. I know Bush Sr. I don't know about Jr. I don't remember, actually.
Not so much.
Okay. I wasn't going to guess. You've met Obama before.
Yes.
You could share that story with us.
Well,
and you were also, at the inaugural.
Yeah. There are a couple of things. When Nance and I were at the Democratic Convention 4 years ago, so a fellow I knew from the Jen Edwards campaign in 2004 came up and said, "Do you want to meet Barack Obama? Barack Obama would like to meet you." Well, I'm as willing to be flattered as the next guy. And he had just given the night before the remarkable speech at the convention 2004. I said, "Sure, absolutely. Can I bring my friend Nancy?" We were not married at the time, and said, "Sure." So we sat down with Obama for about 40 minutes, just the three of us, and I had not met him before. And he and I had a conversation about various political issues which were of concern to me. And he knew a lot about them and gave very fluent, intelligent answers, but I didn't consider that shocking because, you know, my concerns were not novelties in the political world. Mm. Nancy, however, got off with him on the problems of education in the developing world, where she travels extensively and in which she specializes. And he was quite fluent about that. And that was impressive. And then there was him. You know, I've known a lot of political leaders, including, I guess, the last four presidents. And many of them are interesting people in their own way. And frankly, many deserve more admiration than political classes get generally. But there was something about this guy, and I came away and I said to Nancy, I said, "I think that is the sanest politician I've ever met." Mm. Now, sane politicians, obviously, is a special category of human being. You know, there's so many I love, like Barbara Boxer, for example. Obama, there was something about him, you just really felt that he had an inner gyroscope, that he was completely squared away, and he had almost emotional perfect pitch. And I think in that case, my first impression of this guy was right. Because of the degree to which he sustained this entire campaign, where everybody's saying you should go after Hillary more, you should do this, and he was okay. And now he's sort of dealing with the world's most ghastly job, given our times, the same way. I think is very reassuring to people and holds out the hope, at least, that he's going to be kind of special. As to the inaugural itself, that was amazing, and I could talk about it a lot. I mean, two things. If I'm ever trampled to death by a crowd, and I was put in mind of the tragedy of the Kmart guard at the Christmas sale, I hope it's by a crowd as happy and nice as that one was, and as multiracial and as derived from all circumstances of life. But the other thing that struck me particularly is that where Nancy and I were staying, which is relatively near the hill, maybe 90% of our fellow guests were African American. Many of them had brought kids. And a good deal of those kids were too young to really know what was going on. But mom and dad wanted them to be there. And the degree of pride and degree of joy, although it was not hard to imagine, was incredible to see. That in itself, in the overall spirit of Washington, which was sort of like a three-day street festival, was, boy, worth the trip for sure.
Well, a happy place to end. And our thanks to Richard North Patterson, best-selling author, whose latest book, Eclipse, is in stores now. And we also thank our audiences here and on the radio. This program is part of our Good Lit series, generously underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. I'm John McMurtry, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.